for the week of April 26, 2015, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 277, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz. Welcome back from CinemaCon.
Thank you very much. It was a very hectic week in Las Vegas. I didn't lose any money, but then I didn't gamble either. But it was nice to see, you know, a whole bunch of friends and coworkers and people that, you know, I get to see sometimes only once a year at CinemaCon. People like Sam Catalano, who, by the way, is a longtime listener of Showbiz Sandbox. Got to run into him once again at CinemaCon.
Did you see Mariah Carey's show at Las Vegas while you were there? Her number one show? She did all her number one hits?
I did not know she was even performing in Las Vegas.
How were the hookers?
Well, I don't know. I can't legally say that I would, or officially say that I know what you're even speaking of.
Sorry about that. All right. So it was a good week at CinemaCon. I'm sure we'll cover that in the show. What else will we talk about?
Well, on this week's show, we're once again going to be catching you up on 2 weeks of entertainment news.
Thanks, Sperling.
And yes.
Are we having a show next week, by the way?
Yes, we are.
Oh, okay. Good to know.
Yes. You can send your complaints to dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's D-I-R-T at showbizsandbox.com. Or call and leave us a voicemail, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Now, how do you like how I work that in there?
Mm-hmm.
Well, Michael, you did mention I'm getting back from Las Vegas from CinemaCon. And that is, for those of you who don't know, the annual gathering of movie theater operators and motion picture distributors from all over the world. We'll tell you what you have to look forward to at theaters near you during the next year or so. Meanwhile, in Washington, D.C., cable giants Comcast and Time Warner Cable were meeting with federal regulators and discovering merging the two companies was facing stiff opposition.
I missed that because I was downloading HBO Now.
Ah, okay. Well, now you can actually watch it, thanks to them calling off this merger. Indeed, they called off the $45 billion merger, and, you know, absolutely nobody was surprised. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines from the past week. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. We're looking at the box office around the world, of course. We pull our information from RentTrack. There's a link in our show notes. We also pull it from Box Office Mojo, Box Office Profits, The Hollywood Reporter, Variety, LA Times, you name it. And the number one movie around the world, without any doubt, is Star Wars Episode 7. Oh, it was a huge opening weekend. The film was viewed 30 million times on YouTube. And the reports are already in, like, will this movie make $500 million in its opening weekend? I saw it twice. I loved it. When Chewie and Han Solo showed up, I have to admit, I teared up. Chewie, we're home.
Now, I'm just going to warn our listeners. Michael,
it was great. It was concise. It was to the point. It was exciting. I mean, the time just flew by.
It was 90 seconds, actually. I believe it was a full 90 seconds.
Well, so what? It was better than the last three Star Wars movies.
The best part was I turned it on, you know, on YouTube. And there my daughters come running into the room, and then they see Han Solo. First thing they said upon seeing him is,
oh no, what?
Why does he have white hair?
Oh.
I was like, well.
Because he's older.
He's a lot older.
He's just happy to have hair, honey.
Yeah, exactly.
We're, of course, talking about the Star Wars trailer. It debuted. It was the second trailer for Star Wars. The stupidest news story I think I saw about this was an analysis by some company. Where was this? You know, will it gross $500 million in its opening weekend? And of course, that depends. Is it opening in China and Japan and everywhere else when it opens up in North America? You know, for example, Avengers is number one on our box office, but it opened overseas a week early. So no, it won't gross $500 million because it didn't have a worldwide open. That's really, you got to open everywhere, basically, if you want to hit $500 million. But this company.
Well, $500 million on your opening weekend.
On your opening weekend, yeah.
Yes, okay.
This company, Ambui Brand Intelligence, looked at the digital consumption of Star Wars, this second trailer of Star Wars, and analyzed it compared to Fast and Furious 7, 50 Shades of Grey. And based on this data, they reported it will make a global debut of $533.2 million to $539.5 million. Based on how many people watched the second teaser trailer for Star Wars Episode 7.
Well, you know, partly what they're doing.
Point two. Like, they've got it down to the point two.
Yeah, well, what they're doing is nobody will remember if they get it wrong. okay? But if they get it anywhere close to right, they will be able to tout their ability to predict the box office with their secret sauce.
And only an idiot would take that seriously.
Yeah, well, that's what they're doing there.
So anyway, so that was big news on YouTube. But in the box office worldwide, the number one movie was, of course, Avengers Age of Ultron. It grossed $201 million worldwide. It opened in 44 territories. It opens here in North America on my birthday weekend this Friday. At number two around the world is Fast and Furious 7, another $88 million. It's at $1.3 billion worldwide. It's grossed $320 million in North America. And what does that mean, Sperling?
That it is profitable.
That's true. But it grossed $1 billion internationally. It's one of only three movies in history to gross $1 billion outside of North America without the help of North America. So that's a big, big reason why this movie is such a hit. Though, of course, it's made a ton of money here in the U.S. as well. At number three around the world is The Left Ear. This is a Chinese coming-of-age drama. It grossed $27 million. It's apparently based on, I guess, the story of a teenage girl. It's based on a novel. And it, apparently the protagonist is a young woman. I couldn't quite figure it out from what I looked at. But what's interesting is it's the directorial debut of Su Yao Peng, a.k.a. Alex Su. He is a big superstar in Asia, in China and Taiwan. He was in a Taiwanese boy band, which was the first of its kind in Taiwan and sort of started the wave of Taiwanese boy bands and pop culture. His nickname in the band was the Obedient Tiger. The Obedient Tiger. I love that. He went to a top-ranked high school and college while in the boy band. Then he went on to TV shows, acting in them, then acting in film. Then he started producing, and now he's become a director.
And then that's when they found out he was actually cloned. There were four of him.
Yeah, exactly. So that's just kind of, you know, Alex Su, you know, continues on with a kind of an amazing career, doing pretty much everything you can do. $27 million in one territory, presumably China. At number four is the DreamWorks animation hit Home, another $22 million. It has passed the $300 million mark worldwide. At number five is Paul Blart Mall Cop 2. That grossed another $20 million. It's at $60 million worldwide. It costs $30 million to make, so it's well on its way to grossing $90 million and being what might be a profitable film.
Well, it's certainly not a critical darling. I think it's got a zero on the Rotten Tomato meter. And Raul Buril, one of our listeners, he wrote in, do you want me to read this? It's writes in, Dear Show, and by the way, guess how he wrote in? Via email, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. He wrote, Dear Showbiz Sandbox, in episode 276, as Michael was running down the worldwide box office, he remarked on how incredulous he was that it had taken so long to make a Paul Blart sequel. Setting aside for a moment that the sequel ended up bombing at the box office, Sperling, you speculated that the sequel may have taken so long because of scheduling issues. Michael took this and ran with it in entirely the wrong direction, suggesting that Kevin James was unable to make this sequel because of his successful TV career. If Michael was suggesting that Kevin James couldn't make the sequel because of The King of Queens, he should know that The King of Queens ended its run on TV before even the first Paul Blart movie hit theaters 8 years ago. Kevin James has certainly been busy, but not with TV. Since the first Paul Blart in 2009, he's top-lined five movies and lent his voice to one animated film. Quality may not be his strong suit, but his movies make money. He had an inexplicable lull in 2014, but otherwise has appeared pretty regularly at the box office. A more reasonable explanation for why a Paul Blart sequel took so long to be made may be found in last week's box office returns. Your friend, Raul in Oregon.
How quickly our minds... I thought I said that the TV show would have been no reason for him not to have made a sequel quicker. That shouldn't have been any impediment.
Yeah, you did.
Remembering that the show had already ended, but I thought, well, that's stupid. He's got every year, if he's doing TV, he's still got, you know, 3-4 months a year where he can make a movie. So that didn't seem to be the reason. That's what I remember me saying, but I appreciate him pointing at the show. Heck, the show wasn't even on the air anymore, so that's how far off base we were. But no, I have to disagree about taking so long. If you want to cash in on an unexpected hit, the sooner you move, the better, especially when it was a piece of junk in the first place. The first Paul Blart movie was awful, so I didn't expect the sequel to be any good. But if you're going to cash in, do it quick. So, you know, people instead of go, oh, yeah, I saw Paul Blart, they'll go see two. In this case, they're like, oh, right, I forgot about Paul Blart. Yes, but fair enough. The movie was a disaster. He certainly wasn't doing the TV show. Thanks for clarifying the record. At number six around the world is The Age of Adeline. This is a, what is this? It's a Benjamin Button kind of movie about a woman who suffers an accident, remains 29 years old for the next like 100 years.
Yes.
So it has sort of a Benjamin Button type feel to it. It's Blake Lively, right? Or somebody?
Yeah, well, I don't know whoever it is. She's gorgeous.
Oh, well, okay. Well, there you go. That grossed $14 million, which is not very good. At number seven is Cinderella, another $11 million. It's at $475 million. It will pass the $500 million mark before all is said and done. Another success story for Kenneth Branagh. At number eight is Unfriended. That's the low-budget horror flick. It all takes place on a computer screen. I assume they use Skype and things like that during the movie. But it grossed $6 million, and it's at $25 million worldwide.
Little trivia fact here about this movie. It could not
takes place in real time.
Yes, and it could not be subtitled. There was no place to put captions of any kind on the screen or open caption.
Why?
I should
because it was all the screen was filled with text from the computer screen.
Exactly, and it moved around, so you couldn't. You'd have to
jump around so much.
Exactly.
That's interesting. So it's playing in five territories. Does that mean a lot of countries had to reject the movie, or did they dub it?
They either dubbed it or they put subtitles off screen.
This is about a group of young people being stalked by some stranger online. And I guess they talk to each other via video. I assume it's not just text, right?
Correct. Yes. Yeah. They're actually, yeah. So it's a documentary about your life.
At number nine is Ex Machina. This is a sci-fi movie about artificial intelligence. It grossed $6 million as it's expanding in North America and into other territories. It's at $14 million and counting. Pretty good reviews. We'll have to see where it ends up. And number 10 is The Longest Ride. The Eastwood clan continues their dominance of the box office. That's about to hit $40 million worldwide. And number 11 is Insurgent. This is the latest in the Divergent series. It's at $272 million worldwide. If you look at it and think, oh, you know, it costs $110 million to make. It hasn't even hit $300 million yet. This isn't looking good. But guess what? It hasn't opened yet, as far as I can tell, in China or Japan. There isn't even a date yet for China. So there's still good news to come ahead for Insurgent. If it opens in those countries, it will surely put it, you know, past the first movie substantially and into profitable territory. Still, I think it's a disappointment. At number 12 is Woman in Gold, the Helen Mirren film. Tomorrow morning are the Tony Award nominations. We're recording this show on Monday, April 27th, actually. But she's on Broadway in The Audience playing Queen Elizabeth, and she'll probably wake up tomorrow to a Tony nomination for Best Actress in a Play. And her movie is in theaters. It's grossed $26 million worldwide, a nice total so far for a quiet, modest little indie film. And that's the box office for North America.
Oh, I thought you were going to talk about another indie film, Get Hard.
Well, that's not an indie film, is it? It's
no.
Warner Brothers.
I was kidding.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's at number 13. Will Ferrell, Kevin Hart. I was just in my mailbox where the guys who work there, you know, I have a mailbox that I pay for, you know, deliveries and stuff. And those guys see every Marvel movie. They see comic movie. They talk about everything. And they brought up Get Hard. Had you seen this movie? And I said, no, life was too short. And they laughed. It's grossed $100 million worldwide, by the way. So it's probably profitable, depending on the deal that Will Ferrell and Kevin Hart have. But they said, yeah, Kevin Hart. Yeah, they're like, not doing a good job. He needs to start making some good movies, they say. You know, he's just churning them out. You know, he's going to wear out his welcome. He's made like 10 movies in 5 weeks, and they've all been bad. You know, and that's just not going to work long term. So, you know, when the guys at your mailbox start saying Kevin Hart's in trouble, he needs to wake up and pull back and make some good movies.
Yeah, well, you know, there's nothing that accounting for taste. You know, you got to actually know which movies to do.
That's right. So Avengers opened worldwide most territories, not here in North America, goes $200 million, but not in Germany, not as much in Germany. 193 small German towns, the movie theaters in those towns, refused to show the Avengers Age of Ultron. Did this story come up during CinemaCon, or was it not in the news yet?
It wasn't in the news yet because, of course, all of those negotiations were kind of, you know, between Disney and those particular exhibitors in Germany.
And you think they would have been known before the movie opened that people were refusing to carry the movie. They wouldn't agree to Disney's demands. Disney wanted 53% of ticket sales, and they were refusing to reimburse for the expense of 3D glasses, which meant they were going to take more money and the movie was going to cost more for the distributors to show.
Well, depending on the movie, 3D glasses can cost between $5 and $10 million. Now, in the U.S., the distributor pays for them.
Well, good God. I mean, what are you talking about? You mean in North America for, or you mean worldwide? Or what are you talking about?
You know, worldwide, it depends on the movie. But a movie like Avengers Age of Ultron, that's a movie that a lot of people will see in 3D because it was made for 3D. So there
not
will be
really.
There will be more glasses sold for that or needed for that particular movie. In North America, the distributor, in this case Disney, would pay for them. And in other territories, it depends on the territory, the glasses are provided and at the expense of the exhibitor. And that's why there's an upcharge. Sometimes they'll actually charge the patron directly. And if the patron brings their own 3D glasses.
A lot of places they charge people directly. Even in the U.S., you get a $3 surcharge for your glasses.
Well,
that,
yes.
That happens all the time.
That's actually, we'll get to that in a second. But
every time I go to a movie theater, 3D movies cost more.
Right. But in this case, in Europe, let's say in Germany, they'll charge the $3. And if you bring your own glasses, they won't charge you an extra 50 cents for the glasses. Whereas if you need the glasses, it'll be $3.50 extra.
That's all right. They're right. They don't care if you keep the glasses, which they ask you not to do. You're still going to pay something.
Right. Exactly. And that, okay, there's a reason for that.
Yeah. Well, there's a reason because they don't want to pay. They want to charge. Why would they charge you more? Why would they charge you $3 if you bring your own glasses, which you shouldn't be able to do anyway?
Well, and that's, I guess that kind of just brings us right into CinemaCon news, doesn't it?
I guess it does.
Yeah. Well, the reason that they would, and we're kind of skipping ahead here. Is there?
No, we're not skipping ahead. We're where we're supposed to be.
There is a licensing fee. Real D, in many cases, will charge a licensing fee for providing the technology for making it, you know, the film 3D.
Right, so it doesn't matter if you're buying, getting more glasses or not. You got to pay them money for showing a movie in 3D and selling X number of tickets.
Right, and the studio then comes in and says, if we give you the 3D film, you have to, you know, charge more money for it. So as far as the exhibitors, most exhibitors would be fine charging the same amount, 3D or 2D. You know, they're in it to get people in the seats.
And eating popcorn.
Yeah, they could, you know, but at the end of the day, they have to, with Real D and I believe Dolby, certain vendors, Master Image is not one of them. I don't believe Expand is one of them. But there are certain vendors out there, technology providers, that do a revenue share. And this is happening more and more with theater owners. And the only, well, I don't want to say the only, but the prominent revenue share partner for movie theater owners in the past had been IMAX. They would actually, you know, request 4% or some percentage of the box office. Theater owners hate that. They don't want to share their box office with anybody but the distributor. When they pay film rental, they want to be done. They don't want to have to turn around and pay, you know, Dolby for this and IMAX for that and Real D for 3D. You know, they just want to.
Right.
Everybody get your hands
out of cost.
Right. They don't want to have to be worried about any of that. And that's becoming a real problem for theater owners because, you know, in the past, they, you know, it was a 35 millimeter projector. It would last 50 years and the expense was lower. Now you have digital cinema. They just got done rolling out. They are pretty much 93% done worldwide with all the digital cinema rollout. In North America, it's 90, you know, it's almost 99.9% done.
So they've all paid their money for the equipment, but guess what? In 5 years, they're going to need to buy more. They're going to have to do upgrades. They're going to have to do changes because the technology doesn't stay still on like 35 millimeter.
Correct. You know, 35 millimeter, you know, they had a 100 year refresh cycle.
Right. So the guys come to you and they say, hey, you want some new equipment? Great. We'll put it in for you. Don't worry about paying, but we want 3% of your box office.
Bingo. Exactly. Right. And
so it's a devil's bargain. What are you going to do? You can't afford to keep replacing your technology every 4 years.
And yet, if you don't, the question then becomes, are you staying competitive? If you don't put in the reclining seats that so many exhibitors in North America are putting in, you know, apparently, from what we were told at this show and others, those reclining seats can turn a theater that is in the red, that is not making money week to week, month to month, can actually turn it around and make it profitable for health.
Well, that's a very, very short-term phenomenon.
And I think that's what, you know, the question then remains, for how long?
Right, right. I mean, I've actually known people who say, oh, they went to the 84th Street AMC, which got a little run down, and now they've got lounging. Oh, let's go and lie in the lounge seats. It's kind of a novelty. It's kind of nice. We're all bigger in North America, apparently, so we need bigger seats. We can't squeeze into the smaller seats. So, you know, that pays off, but that's not going to boost anybody, especially when your competitor gets it, of course.
Well, and of course, exactly. You just hit the nail on the head. That is exactly where I was going. It's this fear, uncertainty, and doubt. Will the Regal down the street or the independent down the street get those seats before me, and then everybody will keep going to that theater and get in the habit of going to that theater? I better get them first.
Right. I absolutely searched out stadium seating when it was new.
Right.
Because you can see the screen. Now, of course, I expect it. I get angry if there isn't stadium seating. So the trick is not to say, well, let's not do anything. If you find a new way to make the experience better, you should invest in it and do it. But, you know, everyone else is going to do it too.
Well, and in many instances, stadium seating was not paid for entirely by the theater owner because they were renting the theater. And the landlord would come in and say, we will, you know, spend 25% of the stadium seating upgrade. We will have to
bring
pay
more people to the mall.
Right. Precisely. So, you know, again, there you have an exhibitor, a theater owner, not paying for, you know, an upgrade. And now there are all these upgrades coming because, you know, let's face it, Michael, what did you start talking about? Even before box office, you started talking about what you saw on YouTube, and it was the Star Wars. It premieres on YouTube before it premieres in the theater.
I remember buying a ticket to a movie just to see the trailer for Lord of the Rings.
Right. I mean, there are far more options in for entertainment than just going to the movies.
All right. So is this German rebellion? Is this a just a blip on the dial? Is it meaningful? Are they trying to hold the line? Do the studios care? Those guys said no, and now they're missing out on the biggest hit of the year.
I'm sure that, well, it's not the biggest hit. Star Wars is coming down the pike. I am sure, and by the way, that's probably why they're taking their stand now on Avengers. They're not taking it necessarily for that movie. They're taking it for a movie down the line.
Right, which is why studios, if they want to stand up to China, they have to say, all right, you can't have our movie. You're taking too much. If you want to get a country to pay you more rentals, you got to say, yeah, you want this movie. I know you do. You're not getting it.
Well, and I'm sure in the U.S. there are almost every exhibitor, except for maybe the big giant gorillas like AMC, Regal, Cinemark, are saying 53%? Are you kidding me? I'd kill to get that deal. You know, they're probably up to 54, 55 regularly. Whereas in Germany, I wouldn't be shocked if they're at 35, 40, 45 on a regular basis.
And they tried to jump that much?
Yes, I would not be shocked if that was the case in Germany, where they probably went over 50%. And everybody was just shocked that they could ask for so much.
So you think that's just inevitable someday that they'll get to that high price?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Especially now that studios are keeping the movie for every single territory or most territories. They're, rather than sell it off to a distributor, a local distributor, they're saying, look, and this is, by the way, one of the things, if we were to go down bullet points of things I learned at CinemaCon, and I will indeed be writing a post for Celluloid Junkie. Myself and Patrick Von Sikowski were in attendance from Celluloid Junkie at the show. Here are some of the things I learned. International gross, which used to be 30%. Michael, do you remember those days?
I do.
And then it kind of creeped up to 40%. Remember those days?
50% when it hit 50%, half.
Yeah, people were like, okay, well, you know, well, guess what? It's 70% now.
And it's only going to get bigger. 80% makes sense. 90% makes sense.
Yeah, and everybody knew that would happen, especially with China. We already mentioned the digital cinema rollout is done.
What does that mean? It means these studios it means all the exhibitors have bought their equipment, and they're now in North America. Movies are shown digitally. They're not shown on celluloid.
That is correct.
And what's the long-term effect of that? The fact that they're now handcuffed to this new technology, and they need to keep upgrading it every few years, and this is a big long-term expense, and how are they going to pay it?
Well, there's so many. I mean, that's a loaded question. There's so many ramifications down to the technology refresh cycles, down to the commoditization of post-production. We learned that, you know, post-production and all the film labs, they basically, you had Technicolor and Deluxe on the last day of the show announced that they were merging their digital cinema operations. That's a huge deal.
So that means there's fewer vendors for you to go to, so less competition?
Fewer. There's only one now. They basically said, you know what? It's a race to the bottom. We're going to merge our operations as you go out and, you know, hire whoever it is you want to hire because, you know, it's, you know, whoever has a computer and can duplicate hard drives and use a satellite can distribute, logistically can distribute the content.
Tell us about laser projection. What'd you learn about that?
Well, that's another ramification is that now that, you know, you got great TVs at home, these big giant TVs, and people are saying, well, why do I need to Netflix and I can stay home and watch it on my big TV? So what theater owners are doing is they're trying to differentiate what they offer in theaters from what you can get at home. Laser projection is basically taking the bulb that is the projection lamp out of the projector and using lasers instead. It is far, far brighter. However, the FDA still hasn't approved it because, you know, there's some radiation issues that then end up people look directly into the lasers, they could hurt their eyes, but nobody really does that. It's cost prohibitive. So a bulb might last a month and it costs $1,200 US. Whereas lasers will last 30,000 hours and could be good for 10 years and costs about $30,000. So, you know, the cost has to come down.
So you're talking about a way of projecting the image onto the screen that's better.
Much better. You want to talk about 3D. It actually makes 3D bright and work.
I don't care about 3D. And similar to laser projection is HDR, right? What is that?
Okay, now, you know, Michael, how you say you don't like 3D. You don't like...
I just think it's pointless most of the time. It doesn't add anything to the movie. It's not like color, sound, and it's just a gimmick. It's not artistically interesting. 1 in 100 movies will have some interesting 3D. It doesn't matter how good the effect is. It's just not interesting.
What about high frame rate? Do you remember when Peter Jackson did the Hobbit movie in high frame rate? It was 48 frames per second instead of the standard 24.
Yeah, and you could immediately tell the difference, and that was a very interesting thing. And it would need a sea change in makeup and production design and all that stuff in order to make it work. But it could be a step forward in realism. Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, certainly for movement, fast movement is the shutter. And you can really notice it in digital, that kind of like stuttering goes away with high frame rate. Well, people were kind of wishy-washy on that. They didn't really like it when it was shown at debuted at CinemaCon a couple years back before the first Hobbit movie. People walked out of the Colosseum there at Caesar's Palace going, I don't know. It looked like, Days of Our Lives.
It looked weird. It was a weird adjustment, yeah.
HDR, high dynamic range, which requires lasers because it's got to be bright. It means more and brighter colors. It means a wider color gamut. You can actually see more colors, more lifelike colors, and a higher contrast ratio. So the contrast ratio and the color ratio right now is 3,000 to 1 when you go to a movie theater. What was debuted at CinemaCon was Dolby Vision, which is Dolby's version of HDR, and that has a contrast ratio of 1 million to 1. Sony has a contrast ratio of 12,000 to 1, if not a little higher. So it is remarkably different. And
does this make high frame rate look better, or what's the point of this? It's just to take the actual print we already have, or is this a new way to shoot films, or just a way to exhibit them?
Well, high dynamic range, it'll be a little bit of a different way to shoot films because you have to worry about what's actually seen, and the colors and the lighting has to be a little bit different. But high dynamic range is taking all of the information that is captured when you shoot a film and actually being able to present it back to the viewer after compression. I mean, it's absolutely...
So you're closer to like the original print, the original vision of the movie that people captured.
Yes. And to give you some sense, when they showed Inside Out, this Disney Pixar film, which was very, very good, by the way. I mean, I really enjoyed it. Everybody was sobbing, you know, part. It's going to be a hit. That said, they started off with traditional projection in the first, maybe the little trailer, and then they did a split screen with HDR. It was, and then they kind of went to all HDR, and there was a little tagline that said, "Yes, the projector is still on," because it was pitch black. I mean, the blacks are deep black. The hues are gradients. It was stunning how beautiful it was. Normally, you know me, Michael, I'll come out and go, "Yeah, it was okay." You know, high frame rate, they probably shouldn't have shown it that way. HDR is the difference is like going to watch a sporting event on HD for the first time. It's almost as if you can't go back because they showed the Star Wars trailer in HDR as well. You can really tell the difference. It's worth, actually, I would.
So do studios think, do exhibitors think, who pays for it? And do exhibitors think, oh, great, another excuse to raise prices? Or do they think, hey, great, this is a way to differentiate ourselves from what people see in their home, and now we can use this, and people will want to keep going to the movies because it's a better experience? Or are they just going to say, let's charge $3 extra for the screens where we have HDR?
Okay, good question. That goes back to that revenue sharing thing. For the studios, okay, so maybe they have to have an HDR version of the film on a hard drive that they distribute, and a regular version of the film. But you know what? They gave up, the studios, the big Hollywood studios, they gave up on having, quote unquote, one master or one version a long time ago. So will it cost the studios a little extra? Yes, because they have to do a special print grade, you know, a color grade of the film. But it's not that much more. It's not tens of millions of dollars more. It's, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars more. They're not going to turn.
So it's a nominal expense for the studios.
Yeah, I mean, it's an expense, but not a huge one. For the exhibitors, they obviously have to have laser projection. They have to have specific, you know, the ceiling has to be, you know, you want
it
to be dark.
So the theater that they've just upgraded to digital needs to be upgraded again.
A little bit, yes, in certain instances and a lot in others. But Dolby, which is now doing Dolby Vision and the Dolby Cinema, that's what they are offering Dolby Vision. If you want Dolby Vision, you have to have Dolby Cinema. That's the big giant screen, the laser projector. You have to have everything. They are not selling it. They are effectively doing a revenue share with the exhibitor.
Which is what IMAX did originally. They said, do you want to show IMAX? Well, build the screen in your theater, but we want a cut of the revenue.
That's exactly right. So I am sure.
So Dolby is trying to use this to do what IMAX did and say, hey, we want a piece of the pie. Instead of you just licensing our sound system or whatever, we want a cut of the revenue when Star Wars opens up.
That's right.
And what do exhibitors say?
I can tell you they are saying, get your hands out of my pocket. Sell me the equipment or don't. But a lot, you know, look, the ones that can't and never will be able to afford HDR and Dolby Vision and Dolby Cinema, they love it because for them, it makes them competitive. But certain chains are saying, well, AMC, actually, now they've teamed up with Dolby. So AMC said, we're in. I'm sure
so
that's
are they going to just have a dedicated screen or is all of the cinema at Dolby going to be converted to HDR?
Well, right now, it's dedicated screens.
And they're going to charge more money for it.
I'm sure they will.
And that's wrong. That is stupid and short-sighted. You don't charge more for stadium seating. You don't charge more for color. You don't charge more for sound, at least, you know, maybe for a brief beginning. But ultimately, if it's a better experience, all your screens should have it. And that should be what you do in order to keep people coming to the movies. If you want to know why people don't go to the movies, it's because every time you come up with anything you claim or actually believe is better, you charge more for it. Well, and so you feel annoyed and ripped off. If you go see a movie not in HDR, you feel ripped off. You already think ticket prices are too much. Popcorn and soda is too much. So now you're telling me, well, yeah, you know, I don't know why people aren't going to the movies. It's $22 to see this film in HDR. Enjoy.
Well, and that's actually what's being discussed now is the value propositions. And
there's none. The value is people will keep going to the movies, which brings us to the thing, not to move you along, because it's the same story, is something that you've been talking about for several years now on the show, which is the declining attendance of teenagers. Young people, you have been saying for years, are falling out of the habit of going to the movies. They don't go to the movies. They stream Netflix. They watch YouTube. They look at things on their tablet. They don't go to the movie theaters. And now, finally, the studios and everybody are waking up to the fact that, yeah, they're losing an entire generation of people, aren't they? This was the number one headline day one of CinemaCon. Talk to me.
Yes, that is absolutely, you're absolutely, they're finally admitting everybody because the data is there. You know, when you're talking about big data, they're finally, all these theater owners and the studios, they're mining all of those movie going trends and all that data from the loyalty programs. And they're going, wow, we're trending above 60 years old. And we all know
which is fine to have people of more ages go. But the fact is, when you look specifically at like the 18 to 24 year olds, whatever, they just are not going.
Right. And everybody knows. I mean, you know, I talked to one concessions vendor who said that introducing a new candy or a candy bar into the theater is very hard because parents buy their kids what their parents bought for them. So again, if you are not used to going to the movies as a teenager, you probably won't go as an adult, which means the habit and the trend and the practice of a particular cultural practice will just die off.
Right. Teenagers have not been going. They're declining attendance since 2007, which is, by the way, an era when we've had a string of blockbuster comic book movies. That's 8 years now that this declining attendance has been going on. A generation is about 20. So you do that for another 10 or 12 years and you've lost an entire generation that says, why go to the movies?
Well, in the question becomes, are they just pirating? Is there a whole generation of people pirating movies, much like music? Is that, you know, how much are we suffering piracy-wise?
But who's going to have fun watching Avengers on your laptop compared to seeing it in the theater?
Well, that's,
it should be a much better experience, and it is a much better experience. Even when, frankly, we talk a lot about people got great home cinemas, they got great screens, big TVs. It's true. But I'm sorry, it's not with, it's 99% of the time you go to someone's home. Yeah, it's a far better experience than it used to be, certainly VHS. It's a great image, it's good sound, but it's not close to what you'd get in a movie theater. And I don't even mean without an audience. I mean, the picture and the sound in a movie theater now is pretty much far superior.
Yeah, no, I would agree, especially when you see these HDR images, it was kind of like they did that halfway through during the Disney presentation.
Uh-huh.
And then afterwards, you had a few other studios go, and you could see it was like going back to standard definition. It was like, oh, so, look at that horrible image. You know, it was just so sad that, you know, they couldn't have everything in HDR afterwards. It like ruined me.
So they're losing teenagers. They admit that this is an issue and they need to address it. It's not just that they're bringing in more adults, which they should always do and is a good thing, but they're losing teenagers. And their response, in my view, is, oh, let's shake the chairs. Let's have some fog. Let's put in scent. Let's charge extra for anything that's actually good. That seems to be their response. Did they have anything more productive than that panic?
No, right now they're just now coming to grips with admitting it. And I think as far as what will actually work to get teenagers back, well, I think in years to come, we're going to either hear of the case studies in which it worked and or the case studies in which it didn't, and whether they were successful or not.
But what are they doing to get them back? Raising prices?
Well, they're trying to differentiate their offering by saying...
Yes, by raising prices.
Well, and immersive like sound. They're trying to say, look, you can't get Dolby Atmos or Barco Oro or now DTS:X, you know... DCI, the Digital Cinema Initiatives, all the studios got together and said, this is what digital cinema should be. There should be no proprietary technology. Well, you
can't. That didn't last.
That didn't last because now you got, you know, basically a sound format war going on, just like the 90s with DTS and Dolby Digital. So, you know, it's I don't know necessarily.
But we don't care about that. That's just a fight for money between sound companies and studios and exhibitors. For people who go to the theater, whether it's Dolby or Atmos, I'm sorry, the sound is good. I mean, Dolby Atmos or Barco or DTS:X, the sound is good. They don't care.
Yeah, they just basically, but it goes to show you the branding Dolby does. That's why AMC teamed up with them and said, okay, we have AMC Prime, but it's hard to brand your own experience, your own, you know, premium experience. We'll go with Dolby.
Because they shouldn't be branding their own premium experience. That means you go to AMC, and if you want the good picture and sound, you pay extra. And what does that say about the other 18 screens that they have? That they're inferior picture and sound.
Guess what? That is one of the biggest issues that was raised, especially by projector manufacturers, is if they tout all of the laser and all of the HDR, are they going to cannibalize
of course their
other offerings? And the reality is, by the way, the answer to that is yes, you will, and that is the way technology innovation has always worked. You should read Tim Wu's The Master Switch because it goes through that economic trend. The last time and most visible way this was done was when the iPhone effectively cannibalized the iPod.
I don't see the comparison. We're not talking about a company. We're talking about all cinema saying, come to the movies. But don't go to our 14 screens. Go to our 15th screen because that's where the good picture is.
Right.
And they're saying, if you go to those other screens, until those other screens upgrade, and maybe they never will, that's inferior stuff that you're getting. You're getting, if you're not going to Epics, if you're not going to IMAX, why are you wasting your time coming to the movies? That's what they are telling people. They're telling you, stay away unless you come to the big screen. Unless you pay extra, stay away.
And that's why
they're not saying, don't buy a phone. They're saying Apple was saying, buy a phone, not an iPod. It costs more money. We're going to make more money, but you don't need an iPod anymore. Just buy the phone. But the cinemas are saying, don't bother coming to the movies unless you want to pay premium prices and see something special. Otherwise, you're wasting your money. Stay at home and stream it.
And they are actually trying to figure out how to introduce that offering without cannibalizing
their
others.
It's simple. Put it everywhere. If it's good, put it everywhere. Sound and color are in every screen. Stadium seating is in every theater. You can't do it all at once, but that should be your goal. If your goal is to charge more money, you're an idiot. If your goal is to make theater going exciting and fun, then you need to push it out as soon as possible into every theater that you have. You know that AMC theater has HDR on every screen. And people go, God, I want to go to that theater because the other theater doesn't have HDR. I want to see my movies in HDR. And so you make sure you go to that theater.
Yeah, I mean, I would actually seek out a theater that had HDR. It was that good.
Well, you know, we'll have to see if it's I mean, I don't understand how it works. It's just they don't need to reshoot movies in different ways, and it's just going to create a better. This has got more content of the actual image.
Yes, and it looks amazing. I mean, you just look at these images.
Yeah, but you know, animated films are very particular. Those are the ones that work well in 3D, whether 3D is necessary or not.
I thought the same thing when they said, "Oh, we're going to show Inside Out in Dolby Vision HDR," and I thought, "Well, why are you showing us an animated film? Why not show us live action?" They then did show live action, and it was just as good.
Well, but that's selected, you know.
Yes, granted. Yes.
What were they? It was the Star Wars trailer. What else?
The Star Wars trailer. They also showed Tron.
Let's see a drama.
Here's the thing.
Let's see a costume drama.
And Dolby is being very smart about this. You know who they're going after? They're going after the creatives. They're going after the directors who see this and go, oh, wow.
Well, that
oh,
didn't
wow,
work
I want
with
that.
3D. The directors got excited by 3D, but fans don't care, right?
Well, yeah, correct. Fans don't care.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. People don't care anymore. I mean, once a year, you do it with care. There's something interesting, just like there always has been with 3D for the last 60 years. If you make a movie with care and it actually looks interesting for 3D, yeah, people will go. But do 95% of all movies need to be in 3D? Absolutely not. Does The Avengers? Do I need to see Age of Ultron in 3D? I'm not going to. Trust me.
Well, and I can tell you that China right now.
My mailbox guy, not to go back to them again, he was going to the IMAX 3D for everything. He's not seen it in 3D.
Well, really?
No, he doesn't care.
Okay.
His son is sick of it. His son doesn't like it. He says his son complains every time they go. He's like, well, all right, you don't want to see it in 3D? We won't see it in 3D. His son says, I don't want to. He's taking his 10-year-old, 8-year-old kid. And his kid says, I don't want to.
Well, you know, right now, and I may have said this already, but China is really propping up the 3D market. International in general is propping up the 3D market. In North America, it's gone down significantly.
Because the international, they're earlier in the game. It's newer.
Yes, correct.
It's still a novelty.
Correct. Mm-hmm. That's exactly why.
Right. North America, do you think it's going to be 50% for Age of Avengers? I mean, you know, we've been seeing those numbers drop and drop as far as how many people pay for a 3D ticket.
I have no idea. I don't think it will be. If there is, it'll be in the 40 to 50% range, I think.
That's as good as they can hope for this day. Because if you're not going to see Avengers Age of Ultron in 3D, you're not going to see anything in 3D.
Yeah, that's right. You might go see
other than Avatar.
Yeah,
you know, other than something where it screams 3D. I'm sorry, a big comic book movie. If you're not bothering to see that in 3D, then you just don't care about 3D.
Well, and you know, they're saying this year, 2015, will be the biggest box office year on record. I think no duh. I mean, I could predict. You could be born
right.
And predict that. You have Star Wars. There's supposedly 4 potential $1 billion movies. We already had one, Fast and Furious. Age of Ultron is probably the next one.
Unquestionably.
Yeah, okay. So you got Star Wars. Come on. Can it make $1 billion before the end of the year? That is the question.
Well, it'll be released in this year, yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know whether you'll count that as this year.
Well, it'll have 18 days, right?
Yeah, something like that. Like 20,
no, 14 days.
14 days
two,
to
two
make
full
$1 billion.
Weeks.
Dollars. I'm trying to figure out what the other one is. Maybe Mission Impossible?
No, that's probably unlikely. I mean, yeah, those are barely $500 million movies.
Could it be Minions?
I
know what it is. Jurassic World.
Oh, that's a strong possibility. Dude, that would be Universal's second $1 billion movie, wouldn't it?
Yes.
On initial release.
That's right.
All right. There's one other thing I'd love to talk about the CinemaCon, and I'm surprised about your comments about it, and that is the announcement of an animated Spider-Man movie.
Yeah, that was done by Sony. And literally, as it was done, people were like, yeah, okay, we didn't like the last one, okay? So I don't know, why are you doing this? It just seemed, you know, everybody kind of rolled their eyes, and there was some tepid applause.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because putting aside the franchise, I think it's very important and good in the sense of animated movies do not have to be fairy tales or Kitty, you know, there is a whole range of type of movies, sci-fi, fantasy, epic tales, you know, that can be done in animation that aren't done. Movies for older kids, for adults, the movies that tackle different stories. Animation is an incredibly pliable format, obviously. You know, it's animation. And that the opportunity to tell all types of different stories isn't often explored. I say that putting aside the fact that Pixar is very bold and different and unique. You know, their movie, The Incredibles, you know, but like they don't have to be family films. They can be sci-fi, hardcore. They can be R. They can be dark movies. They can be Spider-Man movies. I think that's a really interesting project. You know, not putting aside the fact that they haven't made a good Spidey movie in, you know, 10 years or whatever.
Well, we'll see how that works.
Yeah, but as far as pushing animation into different territories other than children-based movies, which is what I think a Spider-Man movie is, not that kids don't go, but it's not for kids. You know, it's not for families as such. It's more of a broad-based, you know, everybody movie, more for adults than it is for kids, I would assume. It's not going to be a different tone. It's not the Smurfs.
No.
So I think in that sense, It's a nice harbinger of something that more studios should do.
Well, you know, one thing I thought I'd mention is during the Sony presentation, there was, you know, Sony kind of, they had a regime change there. There was, you know, the big cyber attack. So they kind of had to address that in passing. And they did it kind of in an underhanded way, too. Not underhanded, but kind of in a, indirect way. Indirect, yeah, would be the word I was looking for. But they have this movie, the Xmas movie, that stars Seth Rogen and Joseph Gordon-Levitt. And during the trailer for
is
that,
this The Walk is
no Seth The Walk looks good, by the way. That's a Zemeckis movie, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
It was you know, it's a Christmas comedy, basically.
Oh, okay.
With Seth Rogen and Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and as the trailer rolls, it says from the filmmakers who almost brought you The Interview. It was very funny.
That is funny. So yeah, I mean, while CinemaCon was going on, of course, there was another dump of Sony documents.
This I think is against the law. I think what this guy did, I mean, it's out there, I get it, but you are aiding and abetting, in my opinion.
Why? Because it was done at all? Because they didn't try and scrub it?
Well, they didn't try and scrub it, fine, whatever. I think that it was, you know, this is proprietary information of a public company. It doesn't matter that it's a public company. It's still proprietary information. It was retrieved in an illegal manner, and you're kind of putting it in a database and making it available for search, which is what WikiLeaks did. They basically said, here's all the data, which, by the way, if you try and find the BitTorrent of this data now on the internet, it's almost impossible. You can't find it. So yes, there was a hack. Yes, the data was available for a short period of time, but it's gone. You can't find it. Unless you downloaded it last December, it's almost impossible to find. Whereas what WikiLeaks did was put it all in a database, make it searchable, and put it on the internet.
Well, you know, the newsworthiness of it is debatable, I think, more so than you would say. But I don't understand the justification for putting it out there and not trying to scrub things like people's social security numbers and things like and phone numbers and addresses. I don't get that at all. I mean, if you're going to do it, you should at least do it right.
Yes, because there's no public benefit to this at all.
Well, I disagree with that. You know, I mean, even though it was obtained illegally, there's certainly public there's been fascinating interest and stuff coming out of it, absolutely, including potentially illegal maneuvers by the MPAA and other people to try and, you know, get their way on this and that public issue. So there's lots of stuff.
I asked the MPAA's Senator Chris Dodd. He is the head of the MPAA. I asked him directly at the press conference whether the Sony hack or cyber attack, making it known that Project Goliath was being worked on by all these studios, whether it kind of confounded the issue or kind of put a stop to it, and whether it hurt him in regards to that kind of piracy.
Well,
protection.
His job would be to say no.
He said he's not going
to. His job is to say no, of course not. It was legal and it did not hurt us at all.
Well, he said he didn't even go into that. He just said, I'm not going to apologize for protecting the intellectual property of my members.
I'm not going to apologize for breaking the law.
Well,
for collusion.
Well, collusion,
of
yes.
Course, he's not going to apologize for studios cooperating with each other in ways that is outside the law, potentially. Of course, he's not going to apologize. He's a spokesperson for them. What the heck do you think he's going to say? Oh, yeah, you're right. We broke the law. It was wrong. We got caught.
You still got to ask the question.
Yes, but what do you think he's going to say?
Exactly
his
what he said.
His response is not interesting.
No, but still.
What I loved was that Sony actually pirated copies of books about hacking. They stole copies of books like Inside Cyber Warfare. That was on their archives in their database. They had stolen copies online, BitTorrented copies of Jeffrey Carr's Inside Cyber Warfare, which is a common reference book for hacking. That's kind of funny.
Well, next time they should probably read them.
Yeah. Very good.
Well, so you think the whole WikiLeaks Sony thing is a big deal?
I do.
Okay, well, then it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, Michael, you know, I was going to invite you over to my house last night to watch the new episode of Game of Thrones.
Oh, but, wow. That would have been fun.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I received a cease and desist letter from HBO. They cracked down on a bar in Brooklyn, New York called Videology. It was hosting parties for people who wanted to watch the series with a raucous crowd. Hey, why not go to the movie theater? HBO said, and the parties have now ceased. Though, as various news reports pointed out, about a gazillion other bars do the very same thing. They probably just don't promote it. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, I guess. I guess they heard about it and felt they had to do it. I mean, there's literally countless bars in New York and all over the country, I assume, that do this. They did it for Sex and the City, did it for Queer as Folk, they do it for Game of Thrones, they did it for The Sopranos. I don't get it. I mean, I guess they just had to because somehow it came to their attention. I don't understand why they actually did this particular one. If they want to, they could spend all day, every day, sending out cease and desist letters to bars that host parties. I mean, I pass another bar that has, like, you know, specialized Game of Thrones beer.
Now, that should be illegal.
Well, it's not that they're promoting it and selling it, labeling Game of Thrones beer. It's just, you know, mead or something. You know, they just call it some old, ye old England type name.
Oh, okay.
It's not Peter Dinklage, you know, draft.
Okay. Well, this next story, I saw it and I immediately texted you or emailed you saying, hey, I can hear you screaming from here. you know, because they're not just your talent agency anymore, Michael. They're your owners. And I'm talking about William Morris Endeavor. They first expanded into sports in a big way when it acquired the sports-centric agency International Management Group. Say that three times fast.
International Management Group, Beetlejuice.
Okay, now.
Oh, wait.
they redubbed themselves WME/IMG. Say that three times fast. Don't, actually. The company has now paid about $100 million to buy the professional bull riders company, known as the PBR, or as I like to call it, Pabst Blue Ribbon. This group runs the most popular series of rodeo-style events in the world. Focused solely on bull riding, the PBR stages 300 competitions in more than 40 countries with a long-term deal that includes CBS, a dedicated YouTube channel, and overseas partners. They have a potential reach of 550 million households. Plus, they
Does our podcast, by the way.
Yeah, exactly. They draw some 3 million fans to events like their annual stop at Madison Square Garden and the PBR Finals in Las Vegas. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big deal because the PBR needed help. You know, I think they had sort of plateaued here in the U.S. and they need to be taken to the next level. They looked like they were moving in that direction. They floundered a little bit. I think worldwide there's a lot of growth. I think the YouTube channel felt like a step back from the platform they had on basic cable. They're not as much visible on CBS and other channels as they used to be like 5 years ago. So I think it's good in the sense not that they're like growing and going and doing great, but in the fact that they need a little help and they need to have somebody pushing them better. And so, you know, they needed a kick in the pants and hopefully this will be it. But isn't this a little vertical integration? It feels like UTA buying a studio. It just seems weird that agents are literally buying a sporting company.
Well, yeah, I mean, they are slowly becoming more content producers than they have traditionally been allowed to be.
And that's not a conflict?
Well,
I mean, can UTA buy MGM? You know, it
no,
just seems weird.
As a matter of fact, MCA, remember MCA Universal?
Yeah.
You know what the MCA, you know what the A in that MCA stood for?
Agency.
That's right. And that was broken up.
That's right. And speaking of agencies, CAA, good time to be working at CAA, isn't it? I wish I'd been an intern there. I probably would have a paying job by now.
Well, you'd probably be running the place by now.
That's right. They promoted 20 staffers to agent and executive status. Those are two different statuses. So 20 people became either an agent or an executive. They've been promoting from within. People argue from in recent years, though not to the board level, obviously. That's why so many people left. But they lost more than a dozen people. And to boost morale or to fill in the ranks or to make sure more people didn't keep fleeing, they offered up a lot of promotions. But what I don't know is what's the difference between an agent and an executive?
Well, that's actually a fairly easy question to answer. An agent is actually somebody who is responsible for signing clients and representing them and selling them to buyers, to producers, to studios, to networks. Whereas an executive can be anything from, you know, a lawyer in the business affairs department, you know, kind of looking over deals, could be somebody whose job it is to go out there and package things, to package shows.
So less glamorous, less money. You want to be an agent, right?
You're just not responsible necessarily for a specific client.
So Tom Cruise doesn't call you.
Yeah, well, or does, but because you are rounding up packaging a movie for him or packaging a TV show for him, then yes, that would be kind of an executive level job.
Okay.
And some people say it's a better job to have, not necessarily for the glamour of it all, but because
you don't have to hold their hands.
Exactly. Yeah.
But when you talk about the people on the board, most of them were agents, right?
Yeah.
They're not executives. So you're not going to get to the top as an executive.
It's a lot harder. And let's face it, when you have UTA or William Morris or any one of these groups coming to raid your agency, they're not going, oh, let's raid for the executives. They're saying, hey, let's get all the agents that have the A-list artists that we want at our agency. That's what they're really after.
All right. So that's agency. What about concerts?
Well, there are now four. And what I mean is there are four concert promoters that have a worldwide reach. They included up until recently, Live Nation, SFX, and AEG Live. Those were the big three.
I wonder if we're missing some in China. There's probably some big concert promoter there we don't know about.
That's true, but they may not have worldwide reach. Now, those three biggies have just been joined by a fourth. Former AEG Live head Randy Phillips is the CEO of Global Live, which announced a few hires and shows, but little else beyond the fact that they are what is referred to as a 360 company with no ties to the old ways of doing things. They're going to represent artists for tours and merchandise and albums, everything. First up, they have a single show for the Rolling Stones in Indianapolis that they're co-promoting along with a UK arena tour for, the Vamps, which is a UK pop group of four...
You don't know the Vamps.
I don't know the Vamps. They're four cute young guys that... They are not, Michael, they are not a boy band. You know why? Because they play their own instruments and form their group all by themselves. Thank you very much. They have five top 10 singles in the UK. Their debut album is cheekily called Meet the Vamps, and they're already hitting arenas. Big Yiller, Big Whoop.
Why is it cheekily to call their album Meet the Vamps?
Well, because isn't it Meet the Beatles and Meet the Monkees or...
Well done. Meet the Beatles. Well done. Well done. I think it's a big deal. More competition is always good. I think moving the Vamps into arenas right away, I mean, they barely have an album out, I think, is that's pushing them too far, too fast. That's not taking a long-term goal with that band. You should have them in smaller venues where fans can be closer and build up their touring cred and, you know, people don't feel like they're 10,000 miles away. That's cashing in as far as I'm concerned. But there you go. Maybe they should sign up Shawn Mendes. Did you read about this guy? He debuted at number one on Billboard. He's a 16-year-old junior from Canada, just like Justin Bieber was once upon a time. His debut album opened at number one, selling 100,000 copies. That's how sad album sales are. It also streamed almost 5 million times. He beat out Reba McEntire, Tyler, the Creator, the soundtrack to Fast and Furious 7. That's how he got to number one. And how did he become famous? Not with a hit single, but by being on Vine.
Yes. Yes.
Vine, you know, you have 6-second videos. How can you promote your music with a 6-second video? His song Stitches would take 56 vines in order to hear the whole thing. I love you so. I want to know. I love you, me. You know, it's like, I just don't get it, but there you go.
Well, should we call him and tell him that he should immediately get some tattoos and skip right to the Comedy Central roast?
Absolutely.
Netflix, the streaming video on demand service that offers original shows like House of Cards and Orange is the New Black, is on a roll. They blew past their own expectations, adding some 4.9 million paid subscribers to their service. Worldwide, they have 59.6 million streaming subscribers. Their stock soared on this news. Netflix now has 40 million customers in the U.S. alone and 19 million internationally. That leaves a lot of room for growth around the world for Netflix, with countries, you know, I guess they're creating content, original content, in different countries. So, you know, individual territories will have Netflix content just for them. Add in non-paying subscribers, and they have passed 60 million for the first time. Big deal or big whoop?
I guess it's a big whoop in a way, right? They're just moving along. They're doing what they've been doing for a few years now. You know, it'll be a big deal if they start to stumble again.
My question is, wait a second. Who are the non-paying subscribers? I'd like to be one of those.
Well, that's isn't that where you just get like I think that's people who are like sampling it.
Oh,
you
know, trial.
You get a 1 week free or things like that.
Okay.
You know, it's not like the free. They don't have a free platform.
Okay.
Well, but I believe it's people who are watching it for the first time.
Have you seen any episodes of Daredevil?
I have not, but that's, I know they got a second season order and Fuller House is coming, isn't it?
Yes, my kids love Full House. They will literally, they've learned how to search YouTube for clips of Full House. They know all of the characters, Uncle Jesse and the Olsen twins and DJ and Stephanie. It's unbelievable. I had no idea. That they
so,
love
but just clips or do they watch full episodes?
Well, there are full episodes on YouTube if you look hard enough. And they reference them. They'll reference episodes of Full House.
don't they have access to full episodes on like Hulu or something or Amazon or Netflix? Don't you have access to that?
I'm not buying them any of that Full House stuff. I'm trying to get them away from that stuff.
Well, don't you already subscribe to?
No.
Oh, okay.
Okay. All right. I actually do see a lot of Netflix shows, but that's another story.
Okay. So yeah, so then Fuller House, there's a reboot of the show. Some of the original characters will be, but it'll also focus on new characters and their kids and all that sort of stuff. So those people will pop in, like John Stamos as Uncle Jesse, but and he'll be a producer, but it's not going to be him all week, every week.
No.
But and that will probably debut next year, 2016.
Now, is the streaming music service Pandora hitting a rough patch? Or is its strategy of cheap access to tons of music coming apart? The first 3 months of a new year often take a hit at services like Pandora. Less new music is coming out. People use the beginning of a year to rethink all their contracts and so on. So Pandora, they dropped 2.3 million listeners during the first quarter of this year, and they are now at 79 million active users. That's down from the previous quarter and twice as big a drop as they faced in the first quarter of 2014. The company also sees rough waters ahead with court cases, rate hearings, and congressional action looming. Big deal or big whoop.
I think it's a big deal. I mean, they do have a lot of problems coming up on them. Their whole business model is based on people giving them lots of music for almost no money.
Yes. And right? And now, you know, people are saying, we don't want to give you any music for no money unless you pay us a lot of money.
Is this going to spill over into Spotify? That's what I want to know. Is Spotify, because they have the same deal. You know, they've suckered in the labels, but the labels are doing fine because they give them big money cash up front or they give them a stake in their company and therefore the labels make money. But the artists and all those people get screwed up and down the line. So, you know, at some point when they have to be renegotiated, I assume the artists will wake up and say, by the way, we want more of a cut, just like they did with Compact Disc. And just like they did with everything else. So what's happening to Pandora, which I think can be a death blow because it's a ridiculous business plan. You know, they don't have any music. Unless people give them the music for like pennies, they don't have a business.
And unless my kids who love the Taylor Swift channel that they created.
Well, who doesn't?
Yeah, well I can tell you, you know, there isn't that much diversity on that. That I mean, you hear the same songs over and over again.
Well, on that particular channel, sure.
Yeah.
It's only Taylor Swift. How much stuff does she listen to? But yeah, you could listen to other channels with more diversity. They've got, I assume, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of tracks, right?
I would assume, yes.
Yeah, but they're hitting headwinds.
3D TV is also hitting headwinds. It is slowly dying away as a possibility, at least on television. It was never really a success for countless reasons we've expressed on this podcast. You should see episodes, all of them, actually. people watch tons of TV every day, but wearing 3D glasses even for one movie can be exhausting, especially if you're Michael. Plus, watching TV is a communal experience where you talk and share comments and grab a drink from the fridge and, you know, pretty much, you know, go to the bathroom, you know. Could you imagine? It'll look like you're right there when you're going to the bathroom.
Yeah, keep going.
Okay. All of that becomes difficult, if not downright goofy, while wearing 3D glasses. Finally, even 3D in the optimum conditions of a movie theater has grown tiring. So it's no surprise that the dominant satellite company Sky in Europe has downgraded 3D. They've turned their 3D channel into an on-demand-only offering, mostly due to the fact that there's not much demand for a 24-hour channel filled with 3D programming and, frankly, not enough programming to fill it anyway. Big deal or big whoop?
Big deal, right? It's another nail in the coffin. I mean, 3D never happened and never will.
Ooh.
Right? Well, is there any doubt of that now?
It happened. The question is...
No, it didn't. No, what? It was never widely adopted.
Oh, no, you
they
mean
tried,
on TV?
Nobody cared. Never worked.
On TV, yeah. No, it never really worked.
Right.
Jon Stewart leaves The Daily Show after some 16 years.
No.
I know. Tell me about it. David Letterman retires after 33 years in Late Night.
No!
They are mere pikers compared to Don Francisco.
Dios mío.
He created and hosts Sábado Gigante, the Univision variety show that has reigned on TV, get this, Michael, for 53 years.
Good heaven.
And come September 19th, it all comes to an end. The show began in Chile in 1962 and literally spread all over the world wherever Spanish speakers could be found. It was a true variety show with a plethora of offerings like games, celebrity interviews, musical guests, teary audience confessions, and a general aura of anything to entertain. Think Jerry Lewis's Labor Day telethon, but every single week. They literally never had a rerun. 3 hours every single week.
Oh, I didn't know that. Is that true?
Yes. And now
that's awesome.
And now Don Francisco, he's calling it a day, presumably due to the passage of time and a fall in ratings. He's cheerily claimed lots of new projects are in the works. They're on the horizons. But clearly, this is the defining show of his career. Big deal or big whoop?
Oh, it's a big deal. It's the ending of an era. He's going to continue to do his annual telethon. He does a telethon, too, just like Jerry Lewis. I don't remember what the charity or charities are. But he'll still have a presence on TV. But clearly, it's the end of Sábado Gigante. But what really stunned me, forget all this, his real name is Mario Kreutzberger. That's the least Mario Kreutzberger. Oh, my God. I could have fallen over when I read that. I had no idea.
Oh, well, it's like hearing that Ralph Lauren's real name is Ralph Lipschitz, which is true, by the way. Look it up. Buy high and sell low. That's how Netflix might be feeling after its four-picture deal with Adam Sandler. We all warned Netflix about this. First, Sandler just suffered the biggest flop of his career.
I don't think it was a bad idea for Netflix. Did we say that?
No, I was just throwing stuff in there.
Oh, okay.
The Cobbler, directed by once hot director Tom McCarthy, grossed $100,000 in movie theaters.
Nothing.
Got pilloried by film critics. Now he's making his first movie for Netflix, Adam Sandler, that is, as advertised. It's a big, dumb comedy of the sort that's made Sandler famous. A spoof of Magnificent Seven. It's called The Ridiculous Six. But maybe it's a little too dumb. About a dozen First Nation actors, these are Native Americans, they walked off the set when their concerns about offensive jokes and inaccurate costumes weren't addressed. They stressed they knew the film was a comedy, but felt the jokes and the painfully stereotypical costumes were just too much. One typical joke, a cowboy calls a Native woman Beaver Breath, and then she responds, "How did you know my name?"
Hilarious.
Netflix poo-pooed the fracas and insists it's a comedy making fun of all those old Hollywood stereotypes. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop unless, you know, somehow it gains, you know, currency and keeps coming up and people are angry about it. But it's unlikely that people will care that much, I'm afraid. You know, if you want to make fun of old movies and their dumb stereotypes, the Indigenous Americans have to be in on the joke. You know, the joke has to be on the guys, not on the natives. But in this case, like Beaver Breath, the joke is on her, not him. So that's why it's not funny. And, you know, if there's no reason to have dumb costumes unless people make a point about saying, why am I wearing this? They're like, we look like Apaches. We're Cherokee. That's literally what they were telling them. And like, whatever. We don't care. It's a dumb comedy. But to me, the most telling thing is this is a spoof of a Western. You want to talk about when people come in with money and they say, oh, who's got a project they want to make? You know, the Arabs come in with money or Chinese people come in with money. Everybody hits them up with their dream project, the stuff nobody else will greenlight. A comedy about a Western is right up there with, you know, stuff that Hollywood doesn't make because they insist they don't make money. So Adam Sandler says, hey, I can make that Western, you know, that goofy Western I always wanted to make. And Netflix says, sure, go right ahead. You know, that's sort of like, you know, when you're there and you're more experienced, you know not to make those projects that have been sitting around for 10 years that nobody else wanted to make.
Yep. And everybody thought the same thing when this deal was announced. Great. He's taking all the projects that Sony didn't want or Warner Brothers didn't want and heading over to Netflix.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, at least this first one, on the face of it, that's what it sounds like. I didn't know that was true. As long as he's not making tiny little art projects, you know, they should be happy and maybe it'll be funny. Who knows? But it sounds stupid. But then so do all of the Adam Sandler movies.
You know what sounded stupid, actually, is what we're going to talk about during Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And we pretty much, Michael, could have written this, that we could have done this and recorded this at the time, the initial merger was...
No, I don't know that that's true. I thought not to put it on you, but I thought you were saying that this merger was going to happen.
I tried to go back and find where, you know, when we covered it so that I could... Because I probably did say, given the way things work, this probably will happen.
Right. But it didn't. Time Warner and Comcast, the merger between Time Warner and Comcast has collapsed. And it's not because of their dominance in cable TV, is it? The problem, at least the way people are spinning it now, was their potential dominance of high-speed internet.
Yeah, I mean, I think, frankly, both companies were more than happy to discuss their dominance in cable because it kind of deflected from the real problem, which was cable TV is dead. It's like arguing over, you know, your dominance
in VHF.
Well,
it's not dead. It's worth billions and billions of dollars.
Yes.
It's far from dead. And if you're repackaging your channels over the top, they don't care. They still make money, right?
Right, yes. But I mean, it's kind of like you can already see the next technology coming, and usually it's time to start positioning yourself now for that.
And that means high-speed internet.
Right. And that's exactly what Comcast and Time Warner were trying to do. And we're more than happy to talk about, you know, their dominance in cable if nobody noticed the fact that they would actually own, 57% of the market for high-speed internet in North
America.
That's
in North America.
Yeah.
That's huge.
Yeah. Because you would pretty much, if you wanted to reach your consumers and you are a content owner of any kind, whether you're the New York Times with print, whether you're Rolling Stone magazine, whether you're Sony Pictures, if you wanted to reach consumers, you would have to eventually deal with Comcast, if only to hand off content.
And so was it just the fact that they would have too much of the market, or was it the intermediaries, or what was going on here? What was the real concern?
The real concern was they feared regulators, that is, the FCC and the Department of Justice, whether it would stifle innovation and development of the internet, but also over interconnects. And those are the points at which content owners and backbone providers on the internet hand data to last mile providers, internet service providers like Comcast, Time Warner, Charter Communications. And then those internet service providers bring that data the last mile from the internet into your home, onto your computer.
Well, this is where they charge their premium prices. They say, oh, you know, you buy, Joe Blow buys internet, he gets internet. But then they come to Netflix and say, oh, you want it to work well? You got to pay us extra at the interconnection spot, right?
Right. Oh, that's where they
charge a second fee. They charge me for paying for high-speed internet. Netflix has to pay on their end to have a whole support group in order to get the video out. But then Time Warner Cable or Comcast steps in and says, hey, you've got to pay us as well.
Yeah, it's like Comcast coming along and saying, it would be a shame if anything happened to that content of yours as it made its way to your
as
customer.
As it crawls into my screen. Yeah. Right. So that's the problem. They already saw that happening. And
saw it happening. Comcast last year, remember the big fracas between Netflix and Comcast?
Yeah, yeah.
Basically Netflix had to go in and say, okay, fine, we will pay you for an interconnect, for you to basically improve your interconnection equipment and upgrade it so that we have more bandwidth, because you're saying, well, we're not downgrading you, we're just not improving it enough for you to use it. And so they had to go and pay Comcast. Netflix was incredibly open about it because they wanted everybody to know what they were doing.
Right.
And by doing that, they let the regulators know, hey, you know what? Yeah, they are holding our customers hostage. In fact, they're holding their customers hostage, because those customers are paying Comcast to receive this information, this data, and they are purposefully slowing it down to charge us, people who are not their customers yet, money.
Right. And so we popping champagnes in John Oliver's house, right?
Yes. I mean, it just seemed like, you know, originally it seemed like, boy, what a bad idea this was, but it almost seemed hard. You know, how are they going to...
Seemed inevitable.
Yeah, it did seem inevitable, but in a way that was like, it still could be beat. It's inevitable, but it's such a stupid inevitable that maybe it just won't go through. And indeed, it wasn't going to go through. And the head of Comcast was on CNBC, and for 12 minutes, he was answering questions. He never answered a single question. He basically just said, we're looking to the future. The future is bright, and we have $45 billion to play with now.
And so now Time Warner Cable will merge with Charter.
Well, that's the rumors are that Charter, which has only 4.3 million subscribers and is much smaller than Time Warner Cable, will merge with Time Warner Cable, which last year, the whole reason for the merger was that Time Warner Cable was approached by Charter, owned by John Malone, and there was a merger talk there, and Time Warner Cable said, well, we don't want to do that. Let's go talk to Comcast. Well, you know, now those conversations with Charter are looking like they're back on, although Time Warner Cable is in a much better position financially and as a business than they were last year, last February, when they announced.
Why? What happened within the past year?
They've got more subscribers. They've kind of solidified their
business. I thought
cable
was dying, you just said.
Well, more internet customers.
Well, you're saying people are buying only internet from Time Warner?
Yes, a lot of people are. It's the you want fast internet, you've got to get cable right now.
Mm-hmm.
Or you have to figure out some
way
to get
fiber. Well, it's the only
option. Yeah, exactly.
But you're saying there are people who are specifically not buying cable, but they're getting only high-speed internet because they make it very hard for you to buy just internet.
Yes,
they really do. The prices are ridiculous. And you can't get just two. You can't get just internet and phone, or internet and cable, or cable and phone. They make that really difficult too because you'd look so stupid for not buying all three. They make it more expensive half the time.
Yeah, but now they're, you know, I don't know about the pricing, but I do know that especially here in Los Angeles, you have Time Warner Cable there in New York as well. Remember, Time Warner Cable has those two big markets.
Yeah.
And they basically have said, okay, Dish customers are coming to us and DirecTV customers are coming to us and saying, look, we want you for internet. And what all these cable companies are realizing is, okay, we'll sell you just internet. Because eventually, you're going to want to downgrade that Dish package or that DirecTV package because you're going to be getting everything over the internet, which, by the way, we are providing.
And will then cost more.
Yeah. So,
So this is a good thing, I think, for the market. I saw somebody talking about the idea that the government just shouldn't allow two large companies with big market share that are profitable to merge.
Especially
when it doesn't help anyone. All it means is that people are going to go out of work and the companies will become more dominant. And customer quality will also probably suffer. But it doesn't benefit the economy, doesn't benefit the country, and doesn't benefit the industry.
No, and partly this was being done to kind of create a company that could compete against these retransmission fees. That was in part what this was being created for. And that's become seems less of an issue over the past couple of months. We'll see if that rings true. I was really surprised, Michael. This was, yes, it was front page news. But I listened to a number of tech podcasts, which when this was announced was huge news. They wouldn't stop talking about it. And now this was announced that the deal is dead. Nobody's talking about it. It's like, oh, yeah, okay. It's almost like...
Oh, I thought it was big news.
Yeah, I mean, but...
Maybe you're at CinemaCon. You just didn't catch it all.
Yeah, everybody kind of shrugged. In LA, it's big news because right now, 70% of, you know, the population here in Los Angeles can't watch the LA Dodgers because... Huh. Time Warner Cable and Sportsnet LA, which is owned by Time Warner Cable, they broadcast the Dodgers but won't sell the rights to Dish or DirecTV or Charter because they're looking for a high price that none of those services are willing to pay.
Well, so the deal has died, and so have some people in the Hollywood community.
It's time for obituaries. I don't know why I said that in such an upbeat manner. I should have said it really sad. It's time for obituaries.
The first one is Richard Corliss, film critic for the New York Times, film critic for Time Magazine. I don't really personally have a big impression of him or his work. Do you?
No, not really. Not at all, actually. I mean, sure, I read him every now and again, but
really read Time Magazine.
Yeah. And I would agree with Todd McCarthy. You said, I think it was Todd McCarthy, you said most of his quote-unquote important work was for Film Comment, which is still a magazine and still kind of a critical look at films.
Yeah, that was in the 70s into the 80s, I believe, and he gave a lot of people their start, and that's what other friends mentioned to me on their own. I saw that in the Todd McCarthy obituary column praising him, but other people had said, "Oh yeah, you know, that was where he did his really important work." So, it's always sad to see somebody die. There were people who had happy things to say about him, but I don't really, I think very, very, very few film critics are people who are going to grab national attention. He was at Time Magazine, which once upon a time was a dominant cultural force, right? Being on the cover of Time was a big deal. Now they have to pretend when you're on the website, you're on the cover. So it's sort of a passing of an era where younger people never read Time. They don't read Time Magazine. They barely even know what it is.
They don't even read magazines.
That's right.
Well, and I could have sworn we covered the passing of soul singer Percy Sledge at the age of 74. I thought we did that last during our last show, but maybe I'm wrong.
Did we?
I don't know. Maybe. Maybe not. I don't know.
Maybe we did.
I don't know.
He died April 14th. So was that? Did we record our show after that?
I think we recorded on April 14th. I could be wrong.
He's still dead.
He's still okay.
Well, you know, he has a great song, "When a Man Loves a Woman." I was surprised again to see he was in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He's really a one-hit wonder. Great voice, great song. You know, it's a record that will last forever, but it's not a career as such. So it's a little bizarre that he's in the Hall of Fame. Not to wish him any ill will at this stage, but you know.
Well, he said, look, you know, when a man loves a woman, you got to put somebody into the Hall of Fame.
There you go. Fair enough.
We also have the passing or the death of director Paul Almond of 7-Up fame. And if you're wondering what 7-Up is, it's a great documentary series that Mike Apted or Michael Apted is responsible for.
That's exactly what Paul Almond was so bitter about. Are you being funny by saying that?
No, I mean,
Paul Almond. It's a series of films that Michael Apted has continued that basically returns to a group of young people who were first seen when they were 7 years old, hence the name 7-Up. And they return to them every 7 years and chart their life in England. It's fascinating to watch. It's one of the great documentary projects of all time. That's no exaggeration at all.
But it's supposed to be like, you know, proving out the theorem or the theory. Show me a boy at seven and I'll show you the man.
The theory, also known as the quote from the Bible.
Yes.
It's not a theory.
Well, I didn't know whether it was from the Bible. I was going to say the quote, but I was thinking, well, is it from the Bible? I don't know who said the quote.
But Paul Almond is the guy who came up with the idea of speaking to a group of kids when they were 7 years old and talking to them. I don't think he had the intention. He did not have the intention of following them up every year, every 7 years, which is what made it so great. But he conceived the original one and he shot it. And he's the one that launched essentially the 7-Up series. Michael Apted was a researcher on that first film. He helped find some of the kids, and he got the idea of revisiting them when they were 14 and 21 and so on. So Paul Almond is always a little bitter that Michael Apted gets all the credit for it, even though Michael Apted did put the spin on it that made it world famous. But, you know, he launched the project, all credit to him, and he moved back to Canada afterwards, did a lot of work there, wrote some historical novels, and always wished he got a little more credit for launching one of the great film series of all time. So full credit to Paul Almond. He did, in fact, conceive and shoot the very first film in the 7-Up series.
Yeah, wait until people start saying J.J. Abrams Star Wars.
Yeah, exactly. That's, yeah.
Okay, so who else do we have here? Don Mankiewicz died at the age of 93. Yeah, Oscar-nominated screenwriter. I did not know that. When did that happen?
Oh, sure. He wrote I Want to Live, which was a film starring Susan Hayward. It won her the Best Actress Oscar. But, I mean, this is a starry Hollywood family. Talk about nepotism. You know, your uncle's in the business. You get in the business.
His father wrote Citizen Kane, or at least co-wrote it with Orson Welles.
Or even more, if you talk to Pauline Kael. What about his uncle?
Well, Joseph, he wrote and directed. Joseph Mankiewicz is the director of All About Eve, isn't he?
Among many other films, and his son, Ben.
And I think Ben, wasn't he on, like, Turner Classic Movies where he was on...
He is. He's the co-host.
Yeah. Okay. So there you go.
Why are you saying it like that? Yeah. So Don Mankiewicz had a good career. He wrote the pilot episodes for Marcus Welby, MD, and Ironside, along with a lot of other TV shows.
Oh, it's all right here. Okay. I do see it. Yes, you're right. You wrote it all down. Thank you.
His death was announced by his son, John, who is another son of Don Mankiewicz. John Mankiewicz writes for and is an executive producer on House of Cards. So that's a pretty crazy list of people there. So talk about a Hollywood dynasty.
Yes. Well, fortunately for us, that wraps us up with obituaries. Nobody else died.
I assume nobody who knows any of these people actually listens to our show.
You don't know that. You
have no
idea.
Please forgive us if we said anything rude or obnoxious. You know, Richard Corliss, a fine film critic. Percy Sledge, great voice, you know, where you would create an enduring classic of a song. You know, when people get angry, we say, well, it's not a career that deserves me the Hall of Fame. You know, it's like he created a song that will last forever. That's more than 99.9% of people do. It's not a mean thing to say.
Hey, you know what? You should call and yell at us. 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can write to us and let us know what you think. dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can rate and review or subscribe to the show in any podcast aggregator on your iPhone, your Android, your smartphone, your smartwatch, or in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, the Stitchers of the world. Please do subscribe to the show. It does help us out. And links to all the stories, all those links to iTunes and the Stitcher and the email and the phone and our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/showbizsandbox, or you can follow us on Twitter. Search for @showbizsandbox is our handle there. All of this information, links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's show, is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting, at least usually. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's PercySledgeCanSingBetterThanYou.com.
Okay, well, you know, Michael, that's probably true, by the way. But if you...
Oh, it's true. I'm talking about me. You can sing better than me.
Oh, okay.
Not you.
Oh, well, I'm tempted to say not anymore, but if you have trouble finding any of Michael's writing about the entertainment industry there, try MichaelGiltz.com or head on over to the Huffington Post, or you can visit bookfilter.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.